Well, I'm sure you all realized what TBA stood for, the theory of buried anomalies. And that's what we're talking about today. And that will become clearer as we proceed. Oh, wait a minute. This goes directly into here, doesn't it? Yeah, great. Maybe. There you go.
Okay, our next speaker, the talk will be given by two speakers. It's Dick Bond and John Braden from CETA.
So we decided to split things in part to introduce, Jonathan needs no introduction, but I just arrived. So we're going to talk about the kinds of things that we're going to be thinking about over the next period here. and the other thing is, how could I resist amusing you by my famous colorful figures, and you will see quite a contrast between Jonathan and me. For many years, we have been developing a methodology at CETA, which in effect is trying to make relationships with every experiment known to humanity for large-scale structures, CMB, et cetera. We call it web skiing, and each map is a web ski, and what we're trying to do is to make ensembles of web skis, because that's what you need if you're going to fully relate to the experiments. That is to say, you have to get the statistics right. So over the years, we've developed a toolkit for CMB analysis experiments, and the primary purpose from our perspective is to test beyond the standard model of cosmology models with the data. And this has been a, I won't get into the details of exactly how we do this. It involves finding halos, having a field population of density, and characterizing the emissions of various sorts by fine-grained response functions that act on the halos in order to emit things like the cosmic infrared background, and other things. And that's characterized, for example, this is like an all-sky map, and it shows a whole bunch of components that have been set up over time. Cosmic infrared background, I'm going to show you a bit about that. Thermal Sinyaya-Zeldovich effect, kinetic Sinyaya-Zeldovich effect, optical surveys of various sorts. We have engagement in Euclid in Canada and other things. Weak lensing, fundamental to take into account, because every map that exists is lensed, of course, and if you don't take it into account, you're not going to get the statistics right. And another subject area that we're really excited about in our turf, and many other people are, is line intensity mapping, which tries to do a three-dimensional structure of the universe by making use of the redshift space tomography that you get from lines. And so the classic case of that is redshift at 21 centimeter. The Chime experiment is something that's a big deal for us in Canada. But I was just at a meeting at Caltech on CO map, carbon monoxide, which also tells us about structure in the universe. And there's a lot of effort on C2, ionized carbon, and various experiments. And the picture to have in mind is that it isn't just things like Euclid, et cetera, doing the universe out to some moderate, not too moderate, redshift, but we will be, over time, we hope, funding enabled, to pay the universe in all these different ways of looking at the universe. And from that, you try and basically marginalize out all of the complex gas physics and see if you can get the underlying fundamental physics. That's non-trivial, of course, because galaxies are very complicated. So anyway, that's sort of the general thing, and we can look at all sorts of things, coupled dark energy, fuzzy dark matter, neutrino mass things. But today our concentration is on non-Gaussianity arising from the ultra-early universe and the different forms that that can take. And the people who are in this list, very long, the people who have worked on these things with gold around them, are people that are working on this aspect of the project. And there's Jonathan, and there's Froloff, and these two people will be joining us next week. Anyway, And here are some sample things that were heavily engaged in Canada. Microwave background, various large-scale structure surveys, these sort of line intensity mapping things as well. So this is where the data is coming from. And the way, as a theorist, I view this, it's just one single vast multi-messenger experiment that's all deeply correlated. What is it that's correlating it? It is the underlying primordial fluctuations. And if you don't include that all of these signals are correlated through that, you will never be able to do the statistical analysis correctly. So just focusing on how that relates to what we are also spending a lot of time on at CETA is, yes, we want to generate fully correlated non-Gaussian ensembles for these various CMB and LSS probes. And what we're trying to do with this is to understand, and we've got a whole program of generating these things, non-Gaussianities, where the operative word is that we're injecting instabilities of various forms during the inflation period and after the inflation period, and looking in detail at entropy generation, particle creation, et cetera. Particle creation, in a generalized sense, is the origin of non-Gaussianity. And then the issue is, okay, we make these simulations, what do you do with them? Because they aren't like the things that we looked for in the simplest of the plot papers. They're complicated and they change from model to model. So what we want to do is to try and find some kind of generalized forms of things to look for in the data. And as Jonathan's going to expand upon in more detail, we call these non-Gaussian prominences that are localized, and what you would do is you'd go into the data and try and look for them, as will become clear as we go along. A key word here is independent component analysis, and he'll explain that later. So let's just remind ourselves a little bit of what we have learned from the data. Planck non-Gaussian paper, which uses inflation-based templates, and we, by having one single number to characterize all of the structure, it is remarkably accurate. It's expressed in terms of FNL, but the way you should really think about it is FNL times the dispersion of sigma, and so the limit is 0.0006. So in other words, we've dug down really deeply, but that's because we have one single template that we're going after. And once you open up the Pandora's box of possibilities, that's not the approach, but it doesn't mean that there aren't interesting things there. The other approach to non-Gaussianity that we used with Planck was isotropy, a sequence of isotropy and statistics papers, where basically we were going in blindly looking for deviations from Gaussianity, and comes as no surprise to you, there were no strong deviations. Everything is consistent with Gaussian. There are a few anomalies, but unfortunately they are at low multipoles. Too much color. Anyway, so the statistics means that we can't really say anything definitive because the deviations around the two sigma, and there just aren't enough modes. So what that means is you want to go to the 3D, and the 3D is, for example, what you can do with line intensity mapping and with very large galaxy surveys. So we're in quest of this, and I can say this in many ways, but I won't. But it's essentially, we're thinking about the role of phase transitions, the very first ones, through the inflationary regime and at the end of inflation. A phrase that has caught on in the subject heavily is inflation, with all of the fields around, can be thought of as a cosmic collider. And that was based upon positive M squares, so stable particles. And the idea was that you could actually read off a spectrum of particles by appropriately looking at inflation. But the trouble is, the effects are really tiny. But there's a way to have really strong effects if you take M squared positive and turn it into M squared negative. And that's the thing that, for example, Andre Frolov talked about and we've dealt with in a lot of detail now. And if you're thinking of a landscape or something, every time you get a positive eigenvalue, you can get a negative eigenvalue. So these things could well be there and be very important, and they can make much stronger signals. So the characteristic thing to look at, which has been raised many times here, is zeta, which is an entropy-like thing, which involves the energy density, and I won't get into the details of it, but it is the key thing to look at. But look what I put under it, total. Because there are perpendicular degrees of freedom, which are equivalent to zeta, that are characterizing all of the isocurvature degrees of freedom, of which there can be a tremendous number. And that's the sort of rich bath that surrounds the standard inflationary flow. So the parallel direction for a field is the inflaton. The perpendicular direction is all of the other field degrees of freedom, including the graviton, actually. But a lot of things can happen, and we know that. Everybody knows that. I won't get into this. And so I'm going to just give you a short snapshot of the way the data looks via Wiener filtering and quadratic power to show where we are now and where we're headed. But because of the nature of the data, we only probe 9 E-folds. And as you know, there are something like 60 E-folds. So there is a huge territory here, emphasized, for example, by Adrian, of unknown territory. And so the possibilities are enormous there, not just for big bumps in the power spectrum, but also for huge non-Gaussianity. And of course, one of the games that everybody loves these days is to try and get primordial black holes out of it, because that's fun. Okay, so this is what we know about the universe as constructed from the Planck, the temperature, and E polarization. This is a map of zeta that is the mean field map around which there are fluctuations. And these are examples of the fluctuations, which are the errors in the determination of the map. And so, you know, there are the famous anomalies. This is the cold spot. But there is no indication, strong indication of non-Gaussianity in that map, in spite of the fact that it kind of looks like it, but it's just that there aren't enough modes. Another way to look at things is a quadratic map, which is the power spectrum. And this is a representation of all of that information. And here is the territory we have no information on. We have brilliant information over some number of E-folds that are giving us the uniform spectrum. And then as you go to low values of weight number, it blows up because we don't have enough information. And because of the damping with the CMB, as you go to high weight numbers, and the characteristic beam size for Planck, things blow up here. You get a little bit better with large-scale structure. And this, for example, is where this spread will go to with the Simons Observatory. So we're pretty excited about that. And so it's going to improve things here, but it's not going to really do much down here. Just for reference, these are the current constraints on the same kind of graph of the gravity waves from Planck and Bicep-Keck. And this is, there are many ways to do it, but this is basically the limit right now on the S-curvature fluctuations. So this is a pretty good limit. But there are many possibilities for these curvature fluctuations. And just as a point of reference, this is where we're headed. So this is the current constraints on the gravity waves. Simons Observatory, marginalizing over 4 grams and all of that, if it all is done correctly, will get us down to here. Lightbird will get us down to here. And supposedly, CMB stage 4 will get us about a factor of 2 better. Really, you have to do it all together. Okay, so we have this territory that's well mined, less than 9 E-folds, and then everything else. And so here's an example of the inflaton field and its propagation with log A. And it comes down, I mean, this is, everybody knows this, comes down and it oscillates. And the question is how rapidly those oscillations damp and at what, how important are the perpendicular degrees of freedom? So Andre talked all about this story of allowing for perpendicular degrees of freedom and what happens in the kinds of situations that we dealt with in the past is that you oscillate back and forth and back and forth, and there's a small instability which only after many, many oscillations back and forth do you get the huge non-Gaussianities that he was talking about. That's like a slow instability. If you want a big effect in inflation itself, and you're going to deal with transverse degrees of freedom, you have to have the instability occurring relatively rapidly, that is to say, of order Hubble. And so we have done all of these experiments, and we have people that will be coming in next week that are working on it with us in graduate student. And so we're sort of putting structures in with characteristic scales and seeing what the response is. And so Jonathan's going to talk a lot about that, but that's the basic idea. And so let me just remind you, these are E-foldings, and the range that we have observations on are way, way, way up here. And so there's lots of room for doing great damage to the simplicity of a uniform NS result. So we set this up like it's a particle physics experiment with in-states and out-states. And if you have simple in the perpendicular direction, simple m squares, then the bundle of trajectories just stays as a bundle of trajectories, and then outcome is the usual kind of inflationary zeta. But if you put an instability in, then you can have lots of wandering occurring with lots of possible response. In order for to get non-Gaussianity, it isn't just that you have trajectories that wander. You need non-Gaussianity. It's fundamental. If the non-Gaussianity, that is to say the nonlinearity, it's related to particle creation. And effectively what's happening is that there's a burst of energy phonons that are collective that involve all of the fields that are present. And so that's the thing that we try and calculate with accuracy, and Jonathan's going to talk about, and I won't get into the details of that because he'll do it much more eloquently than I will. And he'll probably have a lower pace of delivery. But this is just giving an idea. If we start with a bundle of trajectories and we build in an instability, then the trajectories travel all over the place. They talk to each other as well. And so we have the parallel direction without an instability where you just have a relatively straight bundle. And then this is the perpendicular direction, and so the instability causes it to go all over the place. What Andre talked about is that you would have the bundle that's going back and forth and back and forth, and then after a lot of oscillations, it starts to spread apart. Here, we're doing it over an order some number of E-foldings. And it leads, in the end, but you have to calculate this with a quite sophisticated numerics if you want to get it accurately, it leads to a zeta which has non-Gaussian aspects to it. Okay, so I'm going to give you a quick idea of how this looks in practice as we take the kinds of non-Gaussianity that we get and we propagate it through to observables. And the observables that we're really interested in here, yes, large-scale structure, S data, but I'm going to give examples which are associated with this line intensity mapping because this is going to be one of the big frontiers in the future. Not easy to do, but it will be an enormous enterprise for our subject. So this is an example of the kinds of things that Andre showed where one has the basic inflaton Gaussian-random field, nearly scale invariant, and the kinds of non-Gaussianity built on that are uncorrelated fluctuations that came out to be, with all of the spikiness that he talked about, localized, localized, but quite large scale because they're reflecting a nearly scale invariant spectrum. And so the issue is, can you find this if it's buried in this? Well, you could if you had a pristine picture of this, but you don't because you're looking at things like carbon monoxide, H1, and other things, and we'll see what that looks like. Jonathan's going to talk about this sort of thing, which is the kinds of non-Gaussianity we can get during inflation with this. And so I won't say more about it. It's just that the two things have the following in common: intermittency, localization. Okay, so this is a map of galaxies, and I emphasize the third dimension because that's going to be fundamental to try and draw more modes out. This is a region of the sky, and if you had perfect data on the galaxies, you would have lots and lots of information, but that's really hard to get. This is an example of if you had the resolution of 6 arc minutes, what it would look like in H1. One of the great experiments that is a Canadian product is CHIME, which is a redshifted 21 centimeter, except that the scale of its beam is not 6 minutes, it's about 60 minutes. And so this large-scale structure map, even with the tomography, is being spread over quite a region. That doesn't mean that it's not interesting. There's a lot of large-scale structure information in that. And so we have great hopes for CHIME and other experiments like it, beyond it, for H1 to deliver lots of information. And the best thing to do would be to take this and take this with whatever the observations of the galaxies directly would be, and you cross-correlate them and try and draw out lots and lots of interesting information. This is another example of that. This is carbon monoxide. It just came from a meeting at Caltech that we're heavily engaged in something called COMAP, which is trying over some redshift range to see carbon monoxide with the two dimensions and then the third dimension, which is the frequency of the experiment. Beside that is the cosmic infrared background. Cosmic infrared background is as frustrating as the cosmic microwave background because it is a projection and you don't have redshift information. We do know that it's coming from decoupling from the cosmic microwave background. So if you want to draw out any information on the third dimension, you you need to have something else to play with the cosmic infrared background. Okay, the reason I showed that is because, for two reasons, as you'll see. One is, what does the buried signal look like in the two cases of correlated intermittency and uncorrelated intermittency of the sort that that Andre talked about? So this is a sweep and frequency of CO in this particular case. This is with FNL of 10, and you know that FNL is less than 5 from Planck, but it just gives you an idea. And then this is with, you can get away with a lot more if you have the intermittent non-Gaussianity. But it's really like going down to a buried treasure. And that's the title of our talk, The Theory of Buried Anomalies. Oh, sorry. Okay, you can't read this. There's a tremendous future associated with mapping the universe and all of these different signals to try and draw out this kind of deeply buried non-Gaussianity that Planck only did reasonably on and hasn't really gone after it. And it's going to be, in my view, a very rich subject. And I've showed you the CIV for another reason. We have been trying to characterize the non-Gaussianity by basically taking the maps of the CIV and other things, and essentially doing what's the equivalent of a wavelet or needlet analysis, where you're dealing with two things simultaneously, spatial structure and essentially wave number structure. And it works really well. This is a power spectrum. But what we can get with this are all higher moments shown as a spectrum. And so it's pretty impressive how well it all works with a pretty simple model with respect to Planck. We're dealing with an anomaly now, and this is the endpoint of what I want to talk about, because the 3-point of the cosmic infrared background doesn't agree with our models. And so we're wondering, what is the solution to this? Let me tell you that it's probably not a very anomaly. He's probably associated with something like starbursting. But the reason I'm introducing this is that what Jonathan's going to show is that instead of dealing with bands and multipoles, we in 3D deal with bands in K and characterize the non-Gaussian structure in zeta. And so this is an example of the CIB. And so you will be happy to know that it's the end of Bond's time and it's Braden's time. Jonathan? And probably we should wait till after Jonathan has delivered the cosmic truth before we ask deal with questions from the students.
Just mention that this session, because there are two speakers, it's a longer session, so we'll end at 3:45.
Okay, how long do I have? So like, try and get in 20-ish? Okay. Is there a microphone here? I get to follow Dick, which means there will be a large fluctuation down in the entropy of my slides, probably. Okay, so thanks to the organizers for letting me talk briefly about some exciting things we've been doing at CETA with some longtime collaborators of mine, former CETAzins, and some grad students. So, title's not super important. But as Dick introduced, a big target that we're going after, and basically the way that you're trying to encode all information about the Earth, the universe, is in the co-moving curvature perturbation zeta. Okay. And so, one wants to know, how is this thing generated, and what are interesting epochs to look at where you might expect zeta to be created in the Earth, the universe. So there's this nice relationship you can write down for its time derivative, which is basically just the first law of thermodynamics. And the nice thing this does for you is it relates zeta generation to entropy production, okay? And so that tells you if you want to go look for interesting places where you might have generated zeta, you should go look for places where you expect to produce lots of entropy, right? And so we've heard about many of these epochs already in the workshop. So in the early universe, there's some obvious places you could go look, okay? You could have during inflation, maybe we're not single field slow roll, maybe there's some complicated features on the potential, then you can get things like particle production or evolution of super horizon fluctuations. So this is one obvious place to look. Another obvious place is at the end of inflation, where you basically have to generate all of the entropy in the universe, okay? Perhaps the most violent phase transition in our entire cosmic history. And you might also think that, okay, maybe we start in some weird initial state that's not the vacuum, then as you sort of settle down, you might generate entropy. Right. So here I'm mostly going to talk about this thing. Andre obviously discussed this, and I have some papers if you want to look at the lost thing. Okay. Now, zeta is, of course, not a big quantity. It's order 10 to the minus 5, probably. So if you want to actually figure out what your theoretical models predict, you really need to do these calculations very accurately, okay? And again, if you want to generate entropy, you generally need to have very nonlinear things happening, and so you have to run code, okay? There's really no way around this, unfortunately. I wrote one of these when I was in grad school. You'll do very complex models if you want. Two things I want to point out. The first is that it will scale up to 2048 cube lattice sites minimum. Could probably go higher. But most important for what I'm going to talk about, this thing is very, very, very accurate, okay? So If you want to pull out a tiny signal, you need to make sure that you're conserving energy properly. Okay, so we want to have very nonlinear complex evolution, and just to connect to the rest of the workshop, the first place you might look at is at the end of inflation. So this is just a simulation of inflation ends, field starts oscillating back and forth, and there are parametric instabilities in it. And zeta is, of course, related to the log of the energy density. And this turns out to be a very good variable to characterize the end of inflation, because this is the thing that is basically encoding energy transport in your medium. And so once you become very, very highly entangled, the effect of photon degrees of freedom live in log rho, not the fundamental fields. Okay? And so if you just push go and ask what this thing will do, you will see that it has some very, very complex evolution. Okay. And so there's all kinds of crazy structure in here that's floating around and flying around. And so you might ask, does that imprint itself in zeta? And Andre talked very briefly about one way that this can happen. So I'm not going to say too much more about that. Okay. Another obvious place that you can generate a law of complexity in the universe is the inflaton, or any light degree of freedom. And so normally people will use something like the Fokker-Planck equation to characterize this. But all I'm doing here is I'm just taking a light field, I'm letting the universe inflate, and I'm doing this in 1D just so I can get a very, very large span in the folds, okay? So this is, you should just think of, the freeze-out of the inflaton, okay? So what I started with is a very small sub-horizon patch, and now I'm just letting it evolve. And this orange curve is smoothed over about a Hubble volume, and the blue is the full quantum state of the system, including all the sub-horizon stuff. And so as this goes, you see all these modes freeze out, and you build up all this very complicated structure over many, many Hubble volumes. Okay. And so when people talk about there being the general zeta from the inflaton or from isocurvature perturbations, this is really what they're talking about. Okay, this very, very complex evolution that's happening. All right. And we'll keep going. Eventually, everything will freeze out. All right, so the thing that I'm going to discuss mostly is, okay, generally when people discuss inflation, it's sort of single field slow roll, everything is almost homogeneous, there are tiny little fluctuations on top of it, but inflation may have been a lot more complicated than that. If you think it was a multi-field model, then in general what will be happening is you will find some critical line on some potential surface and you'll follow that along. And as you're doing that, the Hessian around that line might change, and it might change quite dramatically, so you can get a lot of structure in here. And this means that as you're inflating, you can run into features in the potential. So you could run into a big hill, maybe bounce off of it or something. As a very simple model, I'm just going to ask, okay, suppose I'm going along my inflationary direction, and suddenly I have an effective mass perpendicular to it that becomes negative somehow. Okay? So if you want, this is just a very simple model that can, you know, capture structure of various features that you might see. Okay. So just schematically, what we're going to have is there's some inflationary potential, so the field's kind of rolling down this way, and then there's some effective mass that depends on the inflaton. So just think of it as an order parameter for the mass of this transverse direction. At some point, you'll hit a feature where the mass becomes tachyonic, and then you just need something to stabilize. Okay. So what we want to do is we want to take some initial field configuration. Okay, so this is just inflating down here. It's going to run into this feature. And then out of that, we want to know what is the curvature perturbation that I get. Okay, so straightforward calculation from initial state to final state.
Okay. John, can the field get stuck? Can I just end up rolling down this funny new direction and get stuck?
Yes, you could if it was super sharp.
But there must be some probability that some part of the universe ends up down there.
Yeah, but so you're going to keep inflating here.
Well, right, but so I can imagine some large fluctuation in the transverse direction, and I...
You could. That might be a black hole. I mean, you need to figure out exactly how rare these things are, okay? I will show very quickly at the end, like an example where it's super, super steep. Also, then you need to know how this continues, and okay. Oh, and one other thing, what we've done here is we've made the potential close back up. This is just to get rid of the isocurvature modes once you're down here. Okay. All right. So now you can go ahead, you can just run a simulation and ask what happens. So what I'm doing here is I'm going to compute zeta and I'm going to smooth it basically on the instantaneous Hubble scale. And this is just different snapshots as you're going along on a 2D slice through the volume. Okay? So this is sort of very early times when we're still coming down, we haven't seen the tachyonic direction. And these next four panels are as you move through the tachyonic direction. And then this last one is sort of at late times. And if you go ahead and compute it, you will find that this thing actually does freeze out at late times as it should. Okay? And so there's some development of structure as you're going along. Now, of course, we're inflating here. So you get the standard inflationary fluctuations. Okay? So those are there. This is the full zeta that you would have gotten. Okay? But we want to dig out the part that is coming solely from particle production. Okay? So the fact that you ran over this defect. And so the way that you can do that is you can take this theory that has the tachyonic mass in it and one where I did not put the tachyonic mass in and difference the two. Okay? And that gives you a way to characterize the part that is coming solely from the particle production. And when you do that, you will find something that looks like this. Okay? So this is basically the contribution to zeta that comes from particle production. And I hope if you look at this, it looks extremely non-Gaussian. Okay? So basically, there are a bunch of peaks in here. And in between the peaks, nothing is happening. These black dots are tagging three sigma fluctuations above the variance. Okay? So highly, highly, highly non-Gaussian. But it is buried in this other thing. So maybe not obvious to see. Okay? And I just want you to take this as motivation as, again, taking a theoretical model and just working on its implications. We get a zeta that's sort of this Gaussian piece from inflation plus a sum of a bunch of sort of peaky structures that are distributed throughout the volume. Okay? You can now start to look more carefully at what this looks like. And what you might think is, okay, I'm coming along and I hit the tachyonic direction, I'll start to split trajectories. Okay? This is basically this is basically creating an isocurvature mode. But once you've done that, you expect it to sort of back react back onto the adiabatic mode. And so there will be a response in zeta to the production of your isocurvature modes. And so these somewhat non-informative labels are, you should think of this as the maximal isocurvature mode that was created, point-wise, and this is the final adiabatic mode. And the only important thing to notice is these are highly correlated with each other, okay? And this does sort of empirically suggest that there's some sort of response in zeta to the creation of your isocurvature mode at early times, okay? So that would motivate you to think that maybe zeta is something in the form the inflationary piece plus some function of my isocurvature that I generated. Okay. Right. And so as Dick briefly mentioned, this is going to be a highly scale-dependent process. So an interesting thing to go and do is to do a Needlin analysis, which just means you go to Fourier space, you window in a Fourier bin, and then you transform back and ask what the field looks like. So that's picking out structure in only dedicated k-bins. You can do that for a few different choices of k, and you can see how the structure evolves. So the center of the wave number, the left of the horizon, right as you're going through the center of the instability, is this panel right here, more or less. Okay. And you can also ask, okay, how much power do I have in these things? So that's being illustrated here. Do I generate a skew? You can ask about kurtosis, these sorts of things. All right. So the key thing to notice is these are all very k-dependent quantities. Right? Okay. And so now, for Peter's question, you can do much more extreme things. So let's just crank up this instability to be really big. So on the left here, there's no delta m squared. Okay. So this is just the normal potential I would have. On the right, I've made a very, very big tachyonic perturbation. So you should think of this line up here as this curve on the left, as this potential on the left. Okay. So this is really a huge thing. And when you do this, yes, you will basically keep the inflaton from going this way. Okay? So the subsequent future of your universe is whatever is happening down here. Okay? And this is just, you can go through and do the same exercise, ask how zeta evolves, you can ask how it's distributed in Fourier space, and you can, again, find that there's a power peak and also a generation of third moment. Okay. So that was all just theory to motivate that, okay, if we take seriously the fact that the inflationary potential might have had features, we sort of generically get kind of simple and universal forms of the non-Gaussianity. And by that, I just mean, in every case that I showed you, there was the Gaussian piece from inflation, and then some function of some other field, okay? And so there's the inflationary particle production. Andre talked about end of inflation. You can imagine that there's correlated non-Gaussianity where this is a function of this field, or there's sort of the simplified peak model of what these things look like. And so in all cases, it's a sum of a Gaussian and a non-Gaussian signal. And so an interesting question is, how do I separate these things? Okay, how do I characterize non-Gaussianity that looks like this? And so for that, there's a super useful technique called independent component analysis. So for most of you, you've probably never heard of this. But there's a canonical application of this technique, which is you're sitting in a big room, and there are lots of people talking, and so a whole pile of conversations going on, and you want to pick out one specific conversation, okay? So your ear does this automatically somehow. And so what you have is, you know, a bunch of people talking, there's a bunch of sound signals coming out, and now you have some receivers, okay? And if you have an equal number of receivers as conversations going on, what you can do is say, I'm first going to pre-whiten everything to get rid of the variance, okay? And then I'm going to try and combine these signals in such a way that I maximize the entropy, i.e. I maximize the non-Gaussianity of that correlated signal. And that will, you then pick out the most non-Gaussian piece, and that is one conversation that's going on. You do this again, you pull out the next conversation. Okay? And so that might sound like it's crazy and will not work. But just to convince you that it does, what you're really doing is saying, okay, I'm going to start with three signals here. So I just have some sine wave, I have some little bump, and then I have a bunch of noise. I'm going to sum those signals together, okay? And now I want to recover this green and this orange, all right? So again, you can pre-whiten the signal, you can do some fancy stuff. And when you do that, these are your recovered signals, okay? So compare this to this. This is like magic. I was shocked when I wrote a piece of code and this actually worked, okay? All right, so that's like a super simple example. When we're actually doing, you know, Zeta in the universe, it's going to be more complicated. So something that we have started thinking about is how to apply it to these general forms of non-Gaussianity that we're getting, where it's Gaussian piece plus non-Gaussian piece.
Justin,
yes? Okay, so for this case, yes. You don't need any information about shape. Okay. There's three signals, so I need three receivers, and they're randomly mixed together. All you're doing is just randomly orienting those three signals, and okay. There do exist techniques to go after this if you don't know how many signals there are, or if you have an underdetermined problem and you don't have the same number of receivers. Okay. They don't work quite as well, obviously, but okay. And maybe I'll just say one more thing about that. There's two things that you want to do here. First is you want to characterize the non-Gaussianity, in which case you can just say, I have as many receivers as I need. I want to say this is the most non-Gaussian piece. The second thing is I have a piece of data. I want to dig it out of the data, okay? And so in that case, you will have an underdetermined problem. All right, so I'm just going to apply this whole philosophy to this. And this is in early stages, so we're still doing testing in one dimension, okay? Of course, this will be elevated to 2 and 3D in the future. So what we have is some realization of a scale invariant Gaussian random field, and then a particular form of this very non-Gaussian thing, okay? And we add them together and we get some field that looks like this. All right. And now we want to pull this part out. So we just do an ICA. And I started with this is the non-Gaussian field. When I do the independent component analysis, I'll get this, okay? And so there's sort of this noise floor associated with the fact that I had the Gaussian random noise there, okay. And if I have very small fluctuations in the non-Gaussian thing, it's just going to look like Gaussian noise. But the important thing to notice is look at these peaks above that noise floor and compare them to the peaks in this field, okay? So you're really identifying out of this very noisy thing here, okay, what the really, really non-Gaussian parts of your field are. So where all the non-Gaussian energy is being stored. And so, on that, I will conclude. So, what I hope to have conveyed after Dick's nice introduction is that there are interesting forms of non-Gaussianity that you can produce with kind of generic nonlinear dynamics in the early universe. Okay, and these things tend to be of the form of a Gaussian piece plus some highly non-Gaussian signal. Okay, and a nice theoretical thing is that the production of these things is tied to entropy production. And so you have some idea of the types of epochs you want to look at to look for it. Okay, and we're developing some ICA techniques to provide a way to characterize the non-Gaussianity and then subsequently extract it out of data. And so there are three of us who are here this week, and we'll be here for the next few weeks. I think Andre's here till the end of the workshop, and Dick's here till March sometime. And I just want to highlight that we have Thomas Morrison, who's one of the students working on this, who will be here next week, and then Gibran Haider will be arriving in 2 weeks. So if you want to talk to us about this, please come say hi. Okay.
Okay, question for Dick and Jonathan.
So hi, thanks for that. It's a question for Jonathan.
Okay.
So regarding the picking up a noise from the signal, if I have just noise and a cosine, the kind of stupidest thing I would think of doing is like take autocorrelate this, and then the autocorrelation would just pick up the sine. But I guess this is a fancier method because it can pick up more complicated things than just a sine on top of
noise.
Right?
So this is a nonlinear method.
Right.
So if you just do autocorrelations, it's sort of separating Gaussian pieces and linear pieces. The ICA will not separate Gaussian components for you.
It
knows zero about Gaussianity.
I see, okay.
So the nice thing is, it is explicitly designed to say, here's my measure of non-Gaussianity. So what we're using is relative entropy, defined in some specific way we can talk about later. And now I want to find, how do I make the thing as non-Gaussian as I can? That's my most non-Gaussian component, okay? And that's exactly the problem that we're trying to solve here, is where does all the non-Gaussianity live?
And also regarding the simulation you did for the like the field that has a tachyonic burst and then goes back normal.
Yes.
How long, I mean, I guess this must be somehow also related to how non-tachyonic, how big the positive mass is early on. Like if I have a very high, like a very
that will set the size of the initial fluctuations. Yeah. So
right. So the size of the initial fluctuation
so
also
this.
Defines the end.
I didn't
end
say this. Where is the potential? Whatever. Okay. This mass was taken to be much bigger than the Hubble.
Okay.
So it is effectively just the bunch JVs with no super horizon.
So
if you want Minkowski fluctuations.
Jonathan, for the generation of large non-Gaussianity, this intermittent time, what are the effects on the two-point correlation function?
Oh, you get a big peak. Okay, think of this as the two-point. Think of this as the k-dependent two-point. I mean, basically, that's what it is. It's the second moment of these banded k's. So it's basically the power spectrum. So, you know, there's a big... So there's the case where it's just, there's no perturbation to the mass. That's this down here. And then this is the one where you actually have the tachyonic direction.
But what is the factor? What is the size of the peak? I don't understand the units. So it's...
Oh, that's a good question. I will have to ask Tom what he put for units.
Sorry?
I'll have to ask Tom what these units are.
Okay. But it's controllable.
It is, yeah. Basically, if you crank up the tachyonic instability, this will get bigger. I mean, probably saturating if you really do something crazy in end inflation.
So this, you're trying, essentially doing this, as Zick was saying, towards the end of inflation, after the...
Yeah. I mean, another way to think about it is, you know, we measure a tiny little piece of the potential, right? And then there's no reason to, A, correlate that with, like, the minimum you end up in. And there's you know, another 40 E folds to get there. So,
This model seems related to, I mean, there's that model of like Neil Barnaby, and I guess, I don't know if it was Kaufman was involved, but they had a similar thing, right, where you roll past one of these special points, and I guess even Eva and maybe even Deck.
Dan's worked on this.
Modular trapping.
So the difference
do you get similar results, or is this just.
Yes. So there. you don't make the mass tachyonic, you're just hitting a zero. So what will happen is you'll go by, you get one burst of particle production. And the effect in the Barnaby and Shiji paper was you keep rolling, the mass becomes very heavy. So you made these fluctuations that were light, they become extremely heavy, and the inflaton is still light. So now you've got really heavy modes, and then you just bounce on the inflaton over and over and over again without losing energy, and that pumps up a peak in delta phi.
And so how's that different from this scenario? Because it just seems like now you've just supercharged the production of these things that then become heavy again, right?
So here what happens is you get extreme bending of the trajectories down into here. So it's really, in the model where it's just zero mass, at some level you're always the inflaton is just the direction that's going this way. But your actual inflaton is like the tangent to the motion of the field at any point. And so what's happening here is your trajectories actually do bend into here a lot, and so you have a very position-dependent notion of what the inflaton even is.
Other questions?
I don't know if I'm allowed to ask this, but I'd like to ask some general question about this kind of, you know, lattice computation. So when we, basically about the quantumness, so when we do the usual primordial computation of primordial spectrum, we just do the classical evolution because, you know, the coherence would probably lose just after a few e-foldings. But in this case, the scale is not so large, right? And what do you think of the quantum?
Okay, so yeah. There are ways to improve this. I'm quite happy to talk to people if they want. It's very technical, though. So yeah, here the quantum fluctuations are you just realize Bunch-Davies fluctuations, okay? And that's encoding the uncertainty principle in out of quantum mechanics. It does not include sort of the dynamical part of quantum mechanics, which is I should be interfering amplitudes together. So you might ask, okay, is that valid? So that is an exact prescription if you have linear fluctuations. Like it's exactly equivalent to all the orders. The argument that's usually made sort of in the preheating literature and what we're implicitly using is that the fluctuations grow large while they're linear, then you effectively become a classical wave system instead of particles, and then if the nonlinearities turn on, they're not going to boot you out of the classicalness. You can actually improve on this a little bit, and you can show that this approximation is actually an expansion that's being done in h-bar, and this is keeping the first two orders in h-bar. If you keep another order, then obviously what happens is you have to start adding noise into your simulation that will capture the effects that you should be interfering amplitudes. And so they're actually surprising systems. So like vacuum decay, which is a highly nonlinear process where you don't actually amplify modes linearly, is basically captured by this approximation. So, okay. And also, maybe I'll just say this other thing. People who do cold atom dilute gas BECs do an exactly identical approximation with a different equation. And there they have systems where they can be like, does it match my experiment? Okay. And so there are some systems for which it goes down to like the quantum shot noise limit. There are some cases where it does not. And the problem is the quantum noise is like highly dynamical, determined by what this simulation you're doing is doing. So it's first principles hard to determine if it's actually an accurate approximation. But here the fluctuations are generally amplified a lot before they start to interact nonlinearly. So okay. That's a good question.
Okay, any more questions for Dick or Jonathan? Okay, if no more questions, let's thank both of them again.